Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. I'm joined by Amy Benjamin, who joins us from New Zealand. She has been on the Soleri Report twice before. One of the most popular ones we've ever done is her discussion on secrecy based on a wonderful piece that she published on the issue of governmental secrecy. It's a must-listen-to interview. Anyway, so I'm pleased to have her back. She has a new article coming out in January. We'll post it with this when it comes out. It's on the topic of what I call sneaky treaties. So Amy, being a legal scholar and lecturer at a law school, has a much more, I'm sure, accurate description of it, but I'll let her tell you all about it. So Amy, thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report.
Thank you for having me again, Catherine. It's a pleasure.
So tell us about the article, how it came about, and your interest in this topic. You're an expert, clearly, on international law, but this is a particular slice. So lead us into the history of how this became of interest to you and how you wrote the article.
Well, it actually came out of my research. My interest was piqued because in doing my article on secrecy, I came across the work of a very prominent scholar in the United States, former Yale Law School dean and current Yale law professor Harold Coe. And he wrote an article about trying to justify the Obama administration's ratification of the Paris Climate Accords without Congress's involvement. He tried to justify that. And in the course of doing that, he said that the agreement didn't require any congressional approval because it represented just a political commitment on the part of the Obama administration. And that could be seen by the very careful use of language in the accord itself, which the use of certain modal verb forms making clear that the parties to the agreement would only be required to try their best to reduce emissions. They wouldn't be held to account for any outcomes. And from a transparency perspective, because my article was on secrecy, I was interested in that because he was basically saying that we're going to represent the United States commitment and that of all the other parties as just an aspirational commitment. And we're going to use certain modal verb forms, should instead of shall, for example, to sort of obfuscate the level of commitment, obfuscate it for the public, obfuscate it for people who think Congress should be involved in ratifying it. So from a transparency perspective, my interest was really piqued by that. It seemed to me to represent a sort of underhanded, you've used the word sneaky, underhanded way of cutting Congress out of the loop. And so when I was finished, so I included it from the transparency perspective in my article on secrecy. And then after, I thought, well, this is very interesting what Coe and others have been up to with this treaty. And it was sort of kicking around in the back of my mind, this issue of engineering a more coercive global order through devices like manipulation of language in treaties. And then, so that was kind of kicking around in the back of my mind. And then in early 2017, two things came across my desk just in the news. One was a UN bureaucrat writing the Trump administration a letter saying that the administration's plan to repeal Obamacare would violate international law. And I read that letter very carefully.
What?
Because he made some, yeah, it's in the article. I start with the, start it.
That I remember.
Repealing Obamacare would violate international law. Now, That was quite an argument, and I looked at the details of the argument, and I saw that he was reading international doctrine related to the sources of international legal obligation in a very idiosyncratic way, to put it euphemistically. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. It kind of reminded me of Coe and his modal verb forms, right? And then not soon thereafter, another UN bureaucrat by the name of Philip Alston, who's also a major international law scholar, descended upon the United States and did a poverty tour and said that, issued a report saying that the Trump administration's plan for tax reform, tax reduction, might run afoul of international law. And again, he made what seemed to me rather dubious arguments based on the sources of international legal obligation. So By this time, my interest was really piqued because it seemed to me I had three examples of scholars making a very aggressive and dubious arguments based on sources law, which is what international scholars refer to when we're talking about the sources of international legal obligation. So that set me off and running. And a year later, I've got a 70-page article about it.
Well, it's very shocking. Clearly you're writing for a very serious audience, so you're not trying to be shocking. But basically what you've got is a group of people conspiring to create legal treaties without going through any kind of a treaty process and basically manipulating domestic laws top down without any kind of legal process and completely in violation of the Constitution. Yeah, I mean, the hubris is quite amazing.
Oh, yes. Catherine, that is an understatement. It's difficult to read much of the scholarly literature and not get very, very angry. I have to do a little meditation before I delve into it, and certainly before I sit down to write. The academics have been on the globalist bandwagon since the early 90s, and they've consistently provided whatever, arguments in favor of whatever changes in doctrine, legal doctrine, have been needed to engineer globalism. They provide the academic cover, and that is what the article's about. It's an analysis of the scholarly discourse that has been dished up to engineer globalism, and it has been sneaky. And some scholars, not all, but some scholars don't feel like they want to hide that anymore. And as you can see from my discussion of Harold Coe and his reaction to the Trump administration and some of his proposals to stop the Trump administration in enacting its policy agenda, the veil has come down. I mean, some of the proposals right. are extreme, and they don't even try to hide it anymore. So
these are people, these are lawyers who do not believe in the Constitution.
Well, they certainly don't seem to believe in the virtues of representative democracy anymore. I'll certainly say that. And then, yes, I'm sure many of them would be against some of the fundamental protections in the Bill of Rights, such as, the Second Amendment and the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment.
Right. Well, let's go back.
There's democracy and then there's rights, and the Constitution has both, and establishment scholars who tend to be globalists, because that's where the money is, or has been for the last 30 years, don't think much of the Constitution, I don't think.
So let's go back to U.S. Law 101. If a president, if the federal government wants to enter into a treaty, it needs to be ratified by Congress, correct?
Usually. And there are different kinds of treaties. So some treaties uh-huh. are for the Senate by supermajority vote, two-thirds of the Senate, and the House of Representatives doesn't have a say at all.
Uh-huh.
So these are Senate-ratified treaties, and then there have been innovations off of that, which aren't provided for in the Constitution but are widely accepted, and I don't have a problem with them. They're called congressional executive agreements, where uh-huh. you have the president on a board, and then both houses of Congress by simple majority vote approve it as they would a simple, garden variety statute. Yeah.
Right.
But in both cases, some or all of Congress is involved. What the Obama administration did is it innovated a different kind of international agreement that only the president needed to be involved in. And they did it in a variety of ways, but they basically tried to cut Congress out of it, and Harold Coe provided a number of legal justifications and others for those kinds of euphemistically innovative type of agreements where only the president need approve it. So that's quite a big deal. That's quite a big deal.
And so
go ahead.
So we're looking sort of at the international law equivalent of dictatorship, of figuring out how to engineer dictatorship. So the president can enter into a treaty and somehow it can be binding on U.S. law and citizens, even though it hasn't been ratified by anyone in Congress.
That, yes, although the arguments obviously won't be nearly as honest as that. What did the Obama administration do? It did a couple of things. In the case of the Paris Climate Accords, changing the modal verb forms to should, not shall, they could say that the United States' commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions was an aspirational one, therefore a political one, and that the United States, you know, wouldn't be in any kind of legal breach if it failed to reach, you know, a certain level of emissions cuts. And since it was just an aspirational commitment, that Congress didn't need to be involved. The problem with that, the way we can debunk that rather easily, is that pursuant to that political, in quotes, ostensibly political commitment, Obama directed his administrative agencies to enact a very legally binding regulations, administrative regulations that are very legal. And so this political commitment was anchored at the domestic level in with real legal teeth. Okay. And so, you know, President Trump.
But can't those regulations be stopped by Congress?
They can be repealed by the administrative agency, but, you know, that's quite a legal process in and of itself. You need notice and comment rulemaking, blah, blah, blah. It's not so easy to do. And the Congress, the Democrats in the House aren't going to want to be repealing any Paris regulations. So they're not going to be leaning on the EPA and other agencies to do that. So and the agencies themselves might find themselves scrutinized by this Democratic Congress, at least the House, if they were to try to do it. So the point is that these ostensibly political commitments, if they're anchored domestically by regulations, they have real inertia. They're very difficult to dislodge. And so in that sense, well, it is close to a dictatorship, and it's done under very false pretenses, because Obama unilaterally signed the United States up to a political pledge that his successor is finding difficult to dislodge.
So let me bring up one other thing, because during the same period, we see the countries regularly going to war without congressional approval.
Yeah.
And I don't know much about the Iran deal, but what I've been told is it was never even signed by the Iranians. So there's a question of exactly what it is, but as I remember, it certainly wasn't approved by Congress. Isn't that the case?
Yes, it wasn't approved by Congress. I can't vouch for lack of signatures, but
right.
Congress was cut out of that and that as well. I mean, the Iran deal, in a sense, I mean, I think there are other problems with that. You know, what payments were made, how much? Didn't we catch like pallets of cash and the millions of dollars going over there? And I imagine some of that money was kicked back to European leaders and to the U.S. as well.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing is just stinks to high heaven. The fact that Congress was cut out of the loop on that one, Catherine, it bothers me, but not quite so much as the Paris Accords, because with Paris you have real domestic legal ramifications. Regulations in place anchoring that political commitment that constrain the activities of domestic actors, corporations, individuals, everybody. And that's, you know, when you're cutting out the national legislature regarding laws and regulations that will be impacting domestic actors, that's a real coup, right? That's maybe
right.
The most extreme form of a power grab.
Well, let me bring up FASB 56. Because if you add FASB 56, what you're saying is the executive branch can spend whatever they want, whenever they want. They can issue as many bonds as they want. They can keep it all secret, in addition to running around the world and making, you know, secret treaties and deals without congressional approval. So it's appropriations, it's borrowing, it's treaties, it's wars. I mean, what is left for Congress to do?
Well, you know, I'll be quite disappointed in the Trump administration if it seeks to exercise the unilateral international agreement-making power of the Obama administration. because that is a real matter of principle, and they shouldn't do it. They should abjure it. They should recant. They should say, we're not going to be doing this. We will include Congress. So yes, FASB 56 is on the books, and it was put on the books during the Trump administration. But I haven't yet seen Trump and his State Department and his DOJ claim that he can be entering into formal international agreements without Congress's consent. If and when I see that, I'll be very disappointed, because that power is just way too unconstrained.
So let's go back to the Paris Agreement. So we have, in essence, a treaty created without going through a real treaty process. And the president, the new president, canceling our participation in the Paris Agreement, and then just, I think, this week or last week, moving forward with the formal process necessary.
Yes, he has to give a year's notice, yes.
Right. So he gave the notice, now he's moving forward with the formal, you know, the ending. And we see that whole community screaming as if he was abrogating a treaty when he's not.
No, he is abrogating a treaty. A treaty is just an agreement between two countries. It is a treaty, but the most consequential provision of that concerned the emissions reductions commitments of the states signing the treaty. And that was the one that was put in aspirational language. So in those crucial provisions, instead of saying that each state party agrees to, you know, this is a hypothetical, agrees that they shall achieve a certain, you know, emissions reductions outcome. Instead of that, it says, and I'm paraphrasing here, that, you know, they will make their best effort, you know, all things considered regarding their economy and the situation to blah, blah, blah. And making the best effort means that if they fail to achieve the outcome they're aspiring to, that doesn't create a right of redress on the part of any other country. They're not in legal breach. They haven't, you see?
Right.
So it is a treaty, but it contains, but the operative provision is just an aspirational one. So he is withdrawing a treaty, but the criticism is...
So stop right there. Hold on just a second. If the Senate hasn't approved that, how can it be a legally binding treaty on the United States?
Well, I argue in my article that it can't be, that it isn't. If it were purely a political commitment, you see, with no legal ramifications, that would be one thing. I would say that was okay. But as I said, with the administrative regulations in place anchoring it, that makes it have legal repercussions. And all of a sudden, it's not just a political commitment. Now, Paris Agreement was concluded against the backdrop of a framework treaty, I think it was 1992. This was the framework treaty that, I can't remember the formal name, but it's like the UN framework treaty on climate. And the Senate ratified that big framework treaty back in the 1990s, saying that they did anticipate that other agreements to address the climate problem, climate issue, would be entered into pursuant to this framework treaty. But the Senate made clear when it ratified that if any future agreement had legal ramifications or created legal commitments, that the Senate expected that such agreements would be presented to the Senate. In other words, critics of President Trump claim that, in a sense, Paris was blessed by Congress because it was made pursuant to a prior treaty that the Senate had ratified. But it wasn't. And the Senate that ratified the framework treaty clearly anticipated that any future agreement with legal ramifications would be presented to the Senate and or Congress, and Paris was not. So I argue that Paris was not a valid exercise of unilateral presidential agreement-making power, and that it violated the Constitution. That's my take.
Well, there's something else.
In terms of congressional presidential power.
Right. So you're talking law. Let me talk money for a second. I sat down when Trump was considering taking the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. I sat down and I read it, and I hadn't read it before. And what was astonishing to me is you're talking about something that if truly implemented could have unbelievably dramatic impact on the lives and economy of the United States. when you're talking about major, major changes in how people live, where they live, I mean, you're talking about gut-wrenching changes and gut-wrenching, essentially, taxes paid to central authorities. I mean,
and that's why Congress needed to be involved.
Right. So you're talking about something that has unbelievably dramatic impacts on the citizens of the United States. This is not a little thing. You know, this is not, you're talking about, you know, I don't mean to exaggerate, but if somebody said, okay, we're going to go to Paris and agree with everybody, we're going to take away all your homes. You know, the hubris of it is so astonishing. It's hard to describe. And it's also hard to face the backlash that Trump took for doing what any thinking person would have done. I mean, it's exactly what I would have done. I would have just torn the thing up. So it's shocking, one, that they had the hubris to do it. It's shocking if you look at the discussion going on right now, because there's no doubt, you know, you're talking about taking an enormous amount of financial resources and turning them over to a small handful of non-accountable people, you know, who would have enormous central control of the global economy.
Yes. The globalists have been, you know, we've reached a point where the power grab is just so obvious and we can call it out. I mean, it was developing slowly beginning in the 1990s as they did a little bit forward here, a little bit forward there, baby steps. But now, you know, the power grab is just, the power grab is covered by scholars. And it is. They launder the ideas. They're the ones who launder the ideas for the globalists, along with the foundations. And the steps have become bolder and bolder. And the reaction to any resistance has really become bolder and bolder. I mean, just look what's happening in Britain with the people, with the Remainers who oppose Brexit. I mean, some of these globalists are flat out calling for the cancellation of Brexit. Like the Liberal Democrats. I mean, they're really being flushed out into the open. I mean, they're saying now exactly what they want, which is just completely counter to democratic governance and any restraints on centralization of power. It's all very much out in the open now.
So you're talking about a series of constituencies who make a lot of money on centralizing control. So yeah. Let's go back to Co and the group who've been, you know, because this is quite amazing, a group of legal scholars getting together and figuring out how you can create all sorts of binding international treaties without, you know, any congressional approval whatsoever. It's quite amazing.
And the judiciary is involved too, Catherine. There are globalist judges who are complicit as well. And I think the globalists were hoping to get judges in place that would agree and implement some of these scholarly arguments. And some have been quite open to them. And that's one thing we should really watch for in any future Supreme Court nominations. Candidates or the nominees going forward should be really queried about that. And there are a number of questions to ask on that front. But the question of the role of international law domestically and in interpreting key provisions of the U.S. Constitution is one that every nominee should be grilled on.
So let's go back to Co. Who is this guy and where did he come from?
He's a longstanding professor at Yale Law School. When I was at Yale, I didn't take his class, but I obviously knew who he was. And he went on to be the dean of Yale Law School, served a stint as dean. And then he's been in and out of government in the State Department, senior government official, in charge of human rights. I think he had a human rights portfolio at the State Department for a while. And he was in a State Department during the Obama administration, and then he went back to Yale. And he's been in the so-called Trump resistance since 2017. And I think he works with the student clinic at Yale Law to file lawsuits opposing Trump's immigration policies. Obviously, he opposes withdrawal from Paris, has written a couple of articles that discuss that. He might be, for all I know, he might be filing a lawsuit today, tomorrow, or in the next week, seeking to enjoin the Trump administration's giving of notice on Paris. He might say that Trump doesn't have the power to take the United States out of Paris and needs Congress's support, which is a ridiculous argument because Congress wasn't involved in the making of Paris. But he has, and I cite these statements in my article where he says, well, Congress now needs to be involved. I mean, the inconsistency is just mind-boggling because there you had code during Obama's administration saying, oh, Congress doesn't need to be involved in the making of Paris because it's just a political commitment. It's just an aspirational commitment. And now that Hillary didn't win and Trump's in and Trump wants to get out, now to preserve Paris, wants to say Congress has to sign off on the withdrawal. I mean, this is the quality of academic discourse. This is the result-oriented nature, just completely bare-knuckled now. You know, I'm so sick of people deferring to academics and saying, oh, they're experts. I mean, some of these people are just, you know, spout the most idiotic arguments. And they're accepted because these are respectable people.
Right. So when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing and then worked as financial advisor for HUD, my experience was that some of the most powerful pots of money in the country are the endowments at the different universities and foundation, and the Yale Endowment and Harvard Endowment are two of the most powerful. And over time, what I came to realize was the conflicts of interest between what they were promoting academics who were saying and how the endowments were making money. It was, you know, it was a coordinated game. So the endowments
It should be investigated, yeah.
Right. And so I think there's a real, whenever I see an academic from one of the universities that has big endowments, I immediately dismiss them as somebody who's stalking for the endowment, and they may not even know it. You know, they're just the ones who are doing what the endowment needs are the ones who get funded and promoted. But there are
they're the unwitting, they're the useful idiots, and then the ones I don't think Coe's a useful idiot. I think he's a co-conspirator.
Right.
I do. There's a great deal of corruption between moneyed interests and the universities that needs to have the spotlight shown on it. There's a great deal of corruption between these ostensibly nonprofit foundations, the world of the think tanks and the foundations, and the military-industrial complex. And, you know, going forward, we're going to need much greater transparency. We're going to need much greater transparency between the intellectual class, the intelligentsia, and their work product, and the moneyed interests. We have to be enabled to see the connections.
Well, I was sitting in a meeting. I won't tell the whole story here. I've done it in the Deep State series, but I was sitting in a meeting where the secretary was negotiating with some wonderful people from the private sector about the new legislation he was trying to get through for housing. And he had these two little assistants who had just come over from the Heritage Foundation, which at the time was doing a lot of work on housing. And basically they were proposing radical centralization of control of the money into Washington. And one of the private sector guys said, well, I thought you guys were Republican. You were for decentralization. And the kid from the Heritage Foundation said, yeah, but we're here now.
Oh, God.
No, but that's what these guys remind me of. You know, if it makes us money and it's good for us, it's, you know, it's good. It's,
there is a great deal of, the universities are, they've lost their way.
They've lost their way,
and they've got to find it again.
So let's turn to the Global Migration Compact, because that was another example that you suggested that we take a look at in terms of sneaky treaties. What is the Global Migration Compact?
Well, it's a compact. It is a treaty, but it's a set of, again, a treaty. The treaty is legally binding, but it contains its most important provisions are a set of, in a sense, aspirational or political commitments on the part of states' parties to do their best to regularize global migration, regularize it, and thereby promote it and encourage it and enable it. They commit to adjusting their national systems to make immigration into their countries easier to make the requirements more transparent and thereby hope to get more immigrants and more migratory flows up and running, more user-friendly, if you will. Because, you know, every country up till now has had its own rather idiosyncratic immigration requirements and standards and criteria. There's a certain amount of harmonization required by the compact, blah, blah, blah. The overall goal is to get global populations more up and moving. Now, these are political commitments, so no state party can be held to account if they don't achieve a certain amount of change in their domestic regulatory framework within a certain amount of time. They won't be in breach of anything, and there'll be no right of redress on the part of any other state's party. So these are a set of political commitments. But the thing is that these aspirational commitments in the hands of scholars, provided a little time passes, you might get a number of scholars saying that these immigration policies have sort of morphed into something called customary international law, which is a very indirect form of law creation that is based on state conduct. And scholars have a large role in saying whether a norm of customary international law is formed or not. And once it's formed, it binds all states, regardless of whether they signed up to the initial treaty or not. And so,
So hold on just a second. So the United States was one of five who voted against, and we didn't sign it. So you're saying somehow we can still be held accountable to comply?
Possibly. Because there might be a movement. Some time will have to pass. I think quite a good number of states have refused to become state parties to the Global Migration Pact. But in any event, the tactic that's been used in the past is to let a little bit of time pass and say that, and then say that the provisions of a treaty have passed in the corpus of this customary international law. Now, the reason that's important is that the custom, if it's declared to be such and accepted to be such by the international community, will bind any state, regardless of whether they signed the treaty that gave rise to the custom, unless the state is what we say persistently objected to the customary norm as it was in the process of formation. This is all very esoteric. But basically what it does is it's a very useful tactic for globalization because it tends to throw the burden on to the objecting state to strenuously object just to keep out of the evolving customary norm. It's not enough just to reject the treaty, the initial treaty. Then the state has to strenuously object to any customary norm that evolves out of it. And that's very difficult to do because of the doctrine related to persistent objection. So it's just a very clever tactic, which I discuss at length in the article, for ensnaring states that have rejected a treaty or reserved to a treaty. It's very, very clever, and globalist scholars have done it as a matter of course since the 1990s.
So let me ask you about the arms trade treaty, because that's another example you mentioned.
Yes. Now this is a treaty with some binding legal commitments to require states parties to put domestic controls in to ensure that they're not exporting arms to countries where the arms may be used to commit certain egregious crimes against humanity or genocide or crimes against women and children and blah, blah, blah. So basically state parties commit to making sure they don't export arms that are used badly by the importing population. And these are real legal commitments. Now, a number of countries haven't signed. Russia and the United States haven't signed. I don't know about China. But you already have NGO activists in particular out there saying it's just a matter of time before a customary norm develops off of this treaty that will ensnare non-states parties, you know, non-signatories to the treaty, and force them, unless they persistently objected, force them to have to comply with the relevant treaty provisions as a matter of international custom if not as a matter of the treaty, because they refused the treaty. So again, it just customary international law, which was an old-fashioned way of law formation prior to the era of treaties, has been weaponized against treaties. And it's been weaponized in a way that is meant to, I call it the sheepdog function. It's meant to get all the treaty rejectors and treaty reservers into the treaty corral via subsequently arising custom. And it's very sneaky. And the tactic was played out at the domestic level too, in a slightly different scenario, whereby custom is used to get around the fact that sometimes Congress or the Senate ratifies a treaty but does not implement it domestically. And so custom is used to get around that failure to implement too. I wouldn't want to get into with you because it's a bit of a long story, but it's been custom has been weaponized at both levels, domestic and international, to get around the voluntarist problem that treaties pose. Treaties are lovely for sovereigntists like me because there's so many ways the state can register its choices and desires relative to treaties. So treaties are the big enemy, if you will, of globalists, and they're trying to either get around treaties and the voluntarist nature of treaties, or they're trying to redefine treaties.
So let's talk a little bit about the NGOs, because in my experience, the NGOs are up to their eyeballs in all of this stuff. Part of it is if when you talk about weaponizing the process, you know, the more complicated it becomes, the more overwhelming it becomes for many, many people. And when you have a lot of people, whether it's academics or NGOs, funded to figure this stuff out and make it go, you know, you're talking about a tsunami of complexity that can be very overwhelming to the political process.
Yes.
So tell us about NGOs.
Well, the bottom line is I absolutely hate them. I hate them. I hate them maybe almost as much as I hate the nonprofit foundations. I mean, give me a break. They claim to be the global do-gooders doing the public's business, but they're accountable to no one, and their donors are often opaque. And if you scratch the surface of some, I imagine many of these NGOs, you'll probably find Soros or a Soros-like person behind them. So, you know, these are not organizations that can, you know, inject a democratic element into the international political and legal space. They've been touted as just such an element, and I fully reject that. They serve their own interests, and those are their donors. And I think, you know, they're behind some, just as a matter of substantive policies that I personally really disagree with. They tend to be, quote unquote, progressive in their outlook, which means, you know, fascist. So, you know, I think, you know, they came to prominence, they rose to prominence in the 1990s, and then they were demanding seats at all sorts. They were basically demanding seats at the lawmaking, international lawmaking table, at all these conferences and conventions and international lawmaking fora and the like. And they've been held, they've been let in somewhat and by the states. When they've been useful and kept at bay the other times. But they're very loud and they are the international law. They man the international law and politics shriekometer.
Right.
And they're extremely noxious. I'd like to see a lot more transparency regarding their funding. And again, like the foundations and like the academics, you know, whenever they say something, they should have a sign saying, you know, who funded that report.
Well, you know, in the United States, any not-for-profit is required to disclose the last 3 years of their tax returns if you ask. In fact, I once asked the University of Pennsylvania for the last 3 years of tax returns, and they didn't respond. And so I had my attorney write a letter, ask again, and I got a call from, is this during the litigation? I got a call from one of my relatives screaming at me that my brother, who at the time was dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, had called and said he'd been called into the provost's office, and if I didn't back down on the tax returns, my brother would be fired. Now, my brother exaggerates, so I'm sure that isn't exactly what happened. But basically, I was told that, you know, my own family would attack and destroy me if I didn't back down on requesting the last 3 years of tax returns of the University of Pennsylvania. When, and I should mention, I have a BA and an MBA from the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, my goodness. Well, can I ask what happened?
Well, I decided to back down because, in fact, if you look at why I was asking, it wasn't, you know, I can't say that it was of major importance to me. I wasn't planning on writing about the University of Pennsylvania, but they kept asking me to donate money. I used to raise a lot of money for them, and they kept asking me to donate, and I was being very critical of the Harvard Endowment at the time, and I said, okay, well, it's hypocritical of me to criticize Harvard and not at least look at, you know, the place I'm giving money to. So I just felt it was a matter of integrity that I look. But it sent off such a storm, and I don't know if you remember the story of Harvard Watch, but it was Harvard tax returns that outed Harvard's role with Enron, which was quite, you know, it's quite a horrible story of what they were up to. But, you know, so the tax returns can tell you a lot, and any not-for-profit under the laws of the United States has to give you those tax returns. And, you know, it's simply a matter of doing. It's a lot of hard work to get all the documents and go through them and publish them. And unfortunately, now that we don't have a body of investigative reporters, you know, working that beat, it doesn't happen. But you can get it. And you're right. What you'll find is that there's a remarkably small amount of funding for these folks. I'll just tell you one story. I wrote an article once upon a time called Narco Dollars for Beginners that just rocketed around the world because it was basically explaining the intersection between narcotics trafficking, related money laundering in Wall Street and Washington. But it was written to be funny and you know, it was pretty dead on as to how the system worked. Anyway, it was published by Narco News, which was funded, in fact, by Soros. It was one of their grant sources. And anyway, what happened was all of the leaders of the war on drugs got very angry at me and organized and had a meeting with the guy from Narco News complaining about this. And they had an email going back and forth about how they were going to deal with me. And what came out in the email, the guys at Narco News were nice enough to send it to me, was, in fact, they all were funded by Soros, all of them. It was shocking. It was like 10 different groups. They were all funded by Soros. And my big bugaboo with that group was to say, look, let's take out a blank sheet of paper and let's look at how the money works and figure out, you know, the sources and uses of all the dollars. And that's how we'll bring transparency and make progress here, which they wouldn't touch. They wouldn't touch the money with a 10-foot pole, now, given that they were funded by Soros. Now I know why. But anyway, so what came out was all like 10 groups were funded by Soros. And their number one concern was that I was going to take their funding away from them, that somehow I would attract.
Oh, the corruption, the corruption.
I had to write them an email and say, look, I have a brand, and my brand would be destroyed if I ever took money from Soros. So I have no interest in Soros's money, so you have nothing to fear from me. But it was quite astonishing. It's so, you know, here's the thing. On the NGO front, you know, I've had a lot of personal bumping into these groups at various times. It's so centralized, Amy, that if I tried to describe how centralized their funding is, no one would believe me. It's, you know, it's a conspiracy.
That does not surprise me at all. They proliferate, and they proliferate as, you know, branches off a central trunk, if you will. And no one sees the trunk. They just see this plethora, this sea of NGOs all claiming to be do-gooders. And in fact, yeah, you probably can trace their funding back to one or two or just a small coterie of sources. And it's ridiculous. And of course, same with the mainstream media, you know.
Well, but I feel a lot of the people, you know, a lot of the people in the NGOs started off with a really good heart and a good intention. And they don't realize they're getting bought up and then directed. They really, really don't. And they don't see the game of how they get weaponized.
Go ahead.
Naomi Klein had a great book on disaster capitalism called The Shock Doctrine. And she describes how the Ford Foundation financed all these different activists and managed them in Latin America. So as the U.S. interests are going through and raping the place, they keep the activists sort of limited and focused on a limited number of areas so they don't interrupt the play. You know, you kind of see how it works. But you get the feeling.
They do compartmentalize a lot of people. And, You know, I don't know what the percentage breakdown would be. You know, maybe 80% of the people involved in NGOs are sincere, but then 20% are manipulative and corrupt, or maybe 90 right. and 10, or maybe 70 and 30. I don't know, but yes, more than half, I'm sure, are fine. But management, most of management, will be in on it, and they're highly paid. And the thing I most resent is, you know, they're such, you know, virtue signalers, and they're always very quick to condescend and tell us that we're all terrible and barbaric. That's what really, you know, rankles. I mean,
well, you're very eloquent. We have to get you back to talk about human rights as a weapon, because you're very eloquent and you've seen a lot of.
Oh, I hate human rights, Catherine. I hate human rights. I hate human rights almost. No, maybe as much as NGOs. I hate human rights, and I have colleagues here, human rights scholars, and I tell them on a daily basis, I hate your work.
Okay, so I want to turn now to technocracy, because, you know, what I perceive is that there is a real effort underway globally to centralize control. Patrick Wood has done a series of books and sort of defined it as technocracy, but it's replacing markets and democracy with basically rulemaking and software and AI. All these systems make it possible to run, you know, to micromanage everything in one very tight control. And the big play on climate change and the Paris Agreement is basically, now that we've had a financial coup d'etat and created these corporate and investment monopolies, now those monopolies are going to turn around and say, well, you individuals, you and the cows have been destroying the climate. You know, none of these other things that we're doing, nuclear testing, depleted uranium, global spraying, weather manipulation, that's not a problem. You're the problem, and now you're going to, we're going to get together, and we're going to have much tighter control of you, and we're going to reduce your resource, whatever, so that we can be even bigger and more powerful monopolies. Okay, so that's my vision of technocracy, and all around the world you see people pushing back against it, whether it's in Chile or Hong Kong or, you know, just everywhere. The farmers in Europe when I was there were going nuts against all this stuff. But to me, the sneaky treaties are an integral part of this effort for central control. And you have to see it in that context. And this piece is a very, very important piece. And it's very rare. You're the only legal scholar I know who's made it accessible to us.
It's such a compelling, you know, the article in a sense, thank you for the compliment, by the way. The article in a sense wrote itself, because it was such an interesting story to tell. And of course, it had been completely ignored by establishment scholars. And it practically wrote itself because it's just a wonderful story of this project, as I call it, to manipulate the doctrine of international law sources to engineer globalism. And it's an easy story to tell, and anyone listening to it, whether legally trained or not, should be able to understand it. It's, you know, when I came into academia in 2016, there, you know, I came in and there were so many stories that were being ignored, stories in plain sight that were very important. It was such, talk about low-hanging fruit, Catherine. You know, mm-hmm. I could go and write about Libya because no one had written about it in the way it needed to be done. It was such an easy story. Or Syria, or secrecy, or 9/11, and now sources. So many compelling stories are just being ignored by scholars that it's rather easy to do. And it's because the stories have such internal logic, they're rather easy to tell. But I did want to say something about technocracy. The claim to fame of the technocrats and how they justify their power, and I talk about this in the secrecy article and I take aim at this claim, is that technocratic decision making, so they say, is apolitical. It's apolitical. It's just interested in the best possible solution, you know, whatever the context. It's not
the one who makes the most money for our friends.
Yeah. And they're apolitical, right? So these technocrats, you know, they're not left or right, they're not for the rich or for the poor. They're just interested in, I guess, on some sort of utilitarian calculus, the best possible solution given the context. And we see this claim to apolitical expertise pop up in the context of central banking and the Federal Reserve. You know, we're just, you know, pulling the technocratic levers of monetary policy. We're not trying to engineer outcomes or favor any financial or economic demographic. We're just interested in, you know, engineering an optimal monetary policy, as if they had no political agenda at all. And that's how they justify being independent of politically accountable actors, because they say, we are not political, so we don't need to be monitored by politically accountable actors. And in fact, being accountable to politically accountable actors, like the president, for example, would compromise our work. It would make us focus on politics rather than on the facts or on the truth of any given issue. And we see this actually in real time playing out with the intelligence community. I wanted to mention this to you because it's playing out in real time. What do I mean by that? John Brennan was sitting next to a former CIA director. Well, John Brennan is a former CIA director, and he was sitting next to John McLaughlin in an interview that came out, I think, last week, talking about how the intelligence community has been, in fact, they were basically admitting to the deep state intelligence community-driven coup against Trump. They're basically admitting it because more and more evidence is coming out about it. And so they're going to have to admit to it. But what was intriguing about their statements was that they were justifying it on a technocratic basis. They were saying that the intelligence community isn't political. This is what they were claiming. It's not political. It's just about the facts. It's just about seeking the truth. They don't care whose ox is gored. They just want to seek the truth. And they just, you know, it was incredible. And so they were defending themselves in this technocratic garb that of a politicization, and justifying their attempts to impede, take down the Trump administration based on that. So technocracy is, I mean, I think we're at the high water mark of it. I think it's going to go down, but they're not going to go down without a fight. And we have to combat them at their strongest claim. We must contest this claim that they're apolitical. We have to unmask
right.
that.
Well, it's not just that they're apolitical, but that they're extremely intelligent and fact-based. In other words, we're experts and we have access to all the scientific and economic data you need to know what's best. And in other words, we know what's best. Now, what's interesting, 2 weeks ago, we just had a wonderful next episode in our future science series called The Mathematics of the Genetic Code. And when you study, when you study physics and you study reality at the deepest level, what you learn is, you know, we're intelligent, the universe is intelligent, and the whole idea of markets or democracy is to capture that intelligence, is to get the benefit of that shared intelligence. So I'll never forget when I was assistant secretary, when I got there, we were losing $11 million a day in the single family fund, which is required by law to be self-sustaining. So we did this huge actuarial study and came up with a series of proposals of how to fix it. And the deputy assistant secretary's very intelligent, Capel, came in, and he came in with Pricewaterhouse and all these people. And they said, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to keep it secret till we plop it out there, you know, because it's important not to, you know, to keep it all secret. And we've all figured it out. You know, we're the technocrats and we figured it out. We know what we're doing and this is it. And I said, well, you know, I just don't try. I'm into the democratic process. So I said, I want to call in the top guys from all over the field office. So I called in the top 20 guys. They got in the room and they basically ripped it to shreds. And if we'd gone out with it publicly, we would have gotten ripped to shreds. And yeah. It's because once you apply something in a human and financial ecosystem, life is complicated. And you need that intelligence, you know, sort of figuring it out and emerging solutions on a much more emergent basis. And that's what we've seen with these treaty processes. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership was different, you know, but they wanted to keep it secret. But if it had been allowed out in the public to say, okay, what's this going to do in a real world and a real ecosystem? What you realize is the technocrats are way in, way over their head. They just don't have access to the shared intelligence, which makes them phenomenally dangerous and stupid, not to mention all the fake science and fake economics. So,
yeah, they don't necessarily produce good outcomes and usually hope for wars to occur at just the right time to give them cover for the collapse that results as a result of their stupid decision making.
Right, exactly.
But they're not getting their war this time, and that's the problem. They were hoping Trump would give them a war, and so far he's not. They're completely without cover if we're talking about the central banks at the moment.
Right.
They're exposed.
Are the articles coming out in January? You're going to make it accessible, and then as soon as it's available, would you let me know so we can add it to this discussion? But I think, I want to thank you again, because I think the sneaky treaties is a very important component of how central control is being engineered, and it's one that for someone like me is almost impossible to understand, and you have made it understandable, and you say that you can do that, and that's relatively easy, but I know it's a phenomenally, you know, it's quite an intellectual feat. And I have to say, your article on secrecy, your article on 9/11, your article on secret treaties, these are all enormous intellectual feats. And I really encourage the subscribers to plug into them, because the weapon, to me, the weapon of choice to stop all of the centralization is transparency. And you say that, and yet the complexity of it makes it very difficult to make a transparency. And I just think you've done an amazing thing here, Amy, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, you're very welcome. It's very gratifying work. It's very gratifying work. I don't know how many big stories I have left to tell. I do feel with this latest one that maybe I'm done with the big stories.
I don't know.
I mean, I think I've more or less, you know, I've done the US ad bellum. I've done, you know, the regime change wars. I've done Syria and Libya and unmasked those for the ridiculous creatures they were, those wars.
Well, you still have to destroy human rights.
You know, well, I mean, part of the effect of the Libya and Syria interventions, which were done, especially Libya in the name of human rights, was to unmask that agenda as being
right.
Ridiculously corrupt. I don't know how many big stories are still out there, Catherine, but we'll see. It's very gratifying work, and thank you very much for the compliment.
Okay. Okay, well, before we close, anything else you want to add on sneaky treaties and your article, Globalism and the Corruption of Sources?
I think that I would only say that going forward, I think, you know, ordinary citizens, if we could become more aware that this project of instituting a more coercive global order, if we could become more aware of it, and there are things we can do at the domestic level to frustrate it, such as making sure that one key thing is making sure that we put pressure on our representatives in Congress to vet judicial nominees to see what their attitudes are.
Right.
Regarding international law and the role it plays, because the globalists have tried to co-opt the judges. They've wined and dined them and blah, blah, blah. And they're trying to co-opt the judges. But judges should be vetted, not only for their views on, for example, abortion rights or Second Amendment rights. They should be vetted on their views of the role of international law in the domestic American order. And I think we should, you know, pressure especially the Senate, our senators, to be on that topic and to be prepared to vet judicial nominees on that topic. And the other thing is to put pressure on our representatives in Congress not to cede congressional power to the executive branch. Now, again, I don't know that President Trump will try to make international agreements behind Congress's back. I don't think Trump is interested in making international agreements, these big multilateral deals that interested Obama so much. He likes bilateral stuff, but, you know, that's not such a big threat. But Congress should not cede its constitutional role of approving international agreements. And we should, again, that's not part of the general conversation that constituents right. have with their Congress people. You know, what's your stance right. on international agreements, right? That is simply not talked about domestically between citizens and their representatives, but it should be because it's very, very important. What is your position on international agreement and Congress's role in approving them? So what I would leave your listeners with is it's time we as a citizenry get smart and bring this issue to the people who represent us.
Right. Right. I couldn't agree more. Well, Amy Benjamin, thank you for joining us on the Salyer Report. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Catherine. Talk soon.
Bye. Thank you.